Hey, I'm Eric Torenberg, and welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. This week's episode is with Sam Lesson. Sam is a partner at Slow Ventures and founder of Finn, which aims to eclipse Siri by building something like the technology from the movie Her. Sam's made a name for himself both as an operator and an investor, having started and sold Drop to Facebook and invested in companies such as Venmo, Birchbox, and MakerBot. This episode, we talk about the philosophy behind angel investing, product management, his college friendship and connection with Mark Zuckerberg, and why, if he was to give a controversial TED Talk right now, it would be about the end of capitalism. Sam's a fascinating thinker. I really enjoyed this episode. If you like it, tweet at Sam Lesson and let him know, and stay tuned for Finn. All right, here's Sam. Sam, welcome to Product Hunt Live. Thank you for coming on this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so you know, you were at Finn World Headquarters. Tell us about Finn. What is Finn? What inspired Finn?
Yeah, I mean, like Finn, first of all, is very early, to be very clear. But it's a product that Andrew Cortina and I founded together. Almost 8 months ago, we started working on it just kind of in my house. And, you know, it comes, frankly, out of, like, just deep frustration with using our phones. I feel like, I like to say sometimes that my phone feels like it's become a beeper. And it's very interruptive to me. It takes pretty annoying to get things done on it. And so when I think about, like, kind of the core activities that I do a ton of times a day, searching for things, messaging people, and, you know, reminding myself of things or, you know, helping me stay on top of what I have to do, there's a better way. And I feel like, you know, again, like when you think about what Finn is and what we're really focused on building, we're building kind of a very conversational interface, which is obviously the topic du jour these days in Silicon Valley. But we're really, really focused on solving this core set of problems for ourselves first and foremost and for our friends and then kind of going from there, which is, you know, I find every time I have to search something other than maybe a specific location or factoid on my phone, like I just want to kill myself, right? Like it's the number typing on that screen, going through a bunch of Google search queries, scrolling through a bunch of pages. It's like, I just want an answer. And the same thing even goes for messaging. I feel like it's just too cumbersome. And therefore I don't end up interacting with a lot of people I want to interact with. And the same thing goes a lot of times for remembering things like, you know, tell me tomorrow to do X, Y, and Z. It's, things like Siri and Google Now are directionally so interesting. But like as an actual user of these things, I'm just like incredibly frustrated. And Finn's our shot at solving this with kind of a hybridized, you know, human and computer system. It's going really well. It's early, but we're certainly ourselves hyper engaged in it and as are the test users. And we're just starting to bring anyone other than kind of a core set of early test users in to use it. So having a good time.
And it's interesting because, you know, at this stage of your career, you don't have to start a company, you know, or certainly a startup. You know, you had a successful exit to Facebook. You know, you're a partner at Slow Ventures, and you could have been at any other VC firm. So you must have to really want to do this for you to get back into the game.
Well, yeah, I think the same. You know, when you step back for a second, I mean, the same is true of my co-founder Andrew Cortina, who started Venmo, you know, that got sold eventually to PayPal in a few different ways. And when we kind of were starting talking about whether to do this or not, the first thing we really had to like process was like, do we really want to go to a war again? Right? Like startups suck, right? You know, they're so glamorized in the media for being awesome and like fun. And like, but it's just like, I think anyone who's like actually built something before knows that it's just like an incredible amount of pain. and an incredible amount of work. And for us, it came down to two things. One is we really wanted to work together. I actually was Venmo's first investor back in the day. I've known Cortina a very long time. You don't get that many opportunities to build things with friends. And so when, you know, kind of that became a real thing where we were like, wow, like we actually are both aligned timing-wise and can work together, that's like a pretty powerful incentive because you only get so many of those in life with your friends. And the second is, it's just like, I just like want to build stuff for myself, right? Like in the end of the day, like I love technology. I love building things. And for me, this is a problem I've thought about and been working on various forms for a very long time, right? This question of like, how do you build a service? And it's not a novel idea, right? This is her, this is how. This is like every few years, this becomes in vogue to talk about like, when's my awesome digital personal assistant coming in some form or another. But you know, I kind of think at this point, if I didn't do this, I'd just be so pissed for having not taken the opportunity to one, build another thing, and two, to do it with someone I love. So I don't know. It's you know, on the bad days you wake up and you're like, man, this sucks. And I knew it was gonna suck, and I did it to myself anyway. But the good days are totally worth it. And I think feeling like, you know, you get to try to push something new is totally worth it.
Working with friends has also been a theme throughout your career, you know, especially when you decided to go into investing. You chose working with Kevin and Dave at Slow over any of the numerous kind of, you know, VC firms that have been around for a long time. Is that the same philosophy that informed that?
Yeah, so I actually, if I unwind my career, I have never started a job without a close friend. So when I left college, the first job I had is I worked at Bain & Company for 2 years. And in all honesty, probably the only reason I ended up doing that was because one of my closest friends in the world is a wonderful woman named Haley Barna, who actually founded a company called Birchbox later. And she and I kind of convinced each other that we would do it together. And we both go to Bain, New York, which, you know, was a period. And then, you know, after that, I left and started a company with friends from Bain. And then after that, I went to Facebook, where they had acquired a company, but I had a lot of very close friends who were working there already. And then leaving Facebook, yeah, it's, you know, look, Dave and Kevin are people I've known a really long time. I know how they think. I love investing with them. We've been arguing about investments and investing together for years. And Finn is just like, yeah, like Cortina is like the best, right? So I had a moment a few months ago where I was thinking about, you know, companies and thinking about this kind of theme of like what it's like to take a job with people you don't know. And maybe I think it might be one of these things that, I mean, I hope I never really experience. And I feel like it's a great luxury to have never experienced because it seems so scary, right? To be throwing yourself in with people that like, you know, aren't friends. So I don't know. I feel very lucky and it's very luxurious to have been able to so far have my career line up that way.
Is that advice you give to other people?
I think it's a little bit, again, it's a very luxurious position to be in because I happen to like have friends who keep doing awesome things. But I think it's a great luxury. I don't think it's a requirement. I do think for co-founders, it seems crazy to start a company with someone that you don't already know. I know it happens. I know that lots of people do it. Some people do it very successfully. And there are factories like Y Combinator that are designed to like help with that in some way, shape, and form in terms of recombining teams and things like that. But I don't know. I would personally, if you told me to go like meet someone at a startup weekend and start a company with them, like there's just like no chance. Even if I think they're the coolest person I've ever met, it's just like it is such a deep, long, intimate, and important thing. I just like, I can't imagine not having known the person for years.
So I want to get into your, you know, your operating career, your investment career, and then Finn, of course, but let's start even, you know, back before then. You were at Harvard when everything was getting exciting at Harvard. Is that
yeah.
Fair?
I mean, if by everything getting excited, you mean when Facebook was founded, yeah. Then yes.
04? When were you at Harvard?
I graduated 05. Yeah, I was in Kirkland House, which was where Facebook was originally launched from. So yeah, I was around for those days.
Take us back. What was it like during those days?
It was exciting. You know, it was, I always felt like I had this very, so one thing that I think is just an interesting perspective. I love Facebook. I think Facebook's unbelievable. When Facebook launched at Harvard, I was a very, 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 I think I was like a day two user. My user number is 2500. So amazingly, I was the 2500 person to sign up for Facebook, which is pretty shocking considering it was day two. But for me, it had a real deep actual social impact on my life. I have very bad name face recognition. Like I think it's actually genetic in my family. I know my cousins do as well. Like I love people, I love interacting with them, but if you're in a college campus and passing tons of people and meeting new people in parties and then you have to know who's who, it was like actually a real problem for me. And like, so Facebook had this, I'd actually, been pretty close to a company called Six Degrees before that, where my dad was one of the original investors and had written a lot of the social networking patents that then Reid Hoffman, a bunch of other people bought. So like I've been around social networking a bunch and loved the idea. But Facebook like very viscerally improved my college life. And I always had like a lot of like deep belief that if you could connect people and give them more context on each other, that it would really help like drive a lot of new interactions in the world and a lot of things that like could be possible that otherwise wouldn't be. And so, you know, even working at Facebook, you know, when I joined, the first thing I did was start, you know, product managing the Facebook profile and then built Facebook Timeline. And it was just like, it was me working on the things that like were the most interesting and intimate problems for me, right? Which is the easier it is to understand the people around you, the more interactions you can have. And there are great things that come from that when you can kind of trust more than a few, you know, close relationships.
Did you have any sense back then or did, you know, the Kirkland House have any sense of how big it would become or even that it would go beyond college students and be a thing?
So and some people who were also there can challenge me on this. I actually think of the people that were there, I was probably one of the more dramatically bullish on what this could be long term, largely because I had spent a long time watching Six Degrees, right? Which no one remembers, right? But the founder, Andrew Weinrich, is, you know, really one of the pioneers of kind of a lot of the thinking around social networking. And I knew how big that had quickly become. You know, they were ultimately crushed, like a lot of the early companies around this, by, believe it or not, by server costs, right? So there were a bunch of other things that were missing, like it wasn't as intimate, like there's a whole bunch of things that Six Degrees was missing, but the biggest problem that actually ended up crushing them was like they ran out of money because it was too expensive to have users. And so when Facebook launched, I actually was extremely bullish that it was gonna be really, really big, I think before a lot of other people were. That said, like the scale to which it is now at is certainly dramatically beyond even like my wildest dreams for what it possibly could have become when I first saw it.
Did you want to join it early? Did you think about that or?
Many times. I had done some projects with the Facebook guys super early. You know, back in the Kirkland House days and things like that, and certainly talked to them a lot and loved what they were doing. I was kind of on my own path, you know, like I was really interested in a bunch of different, you know, businesses. I really wanted to found something myself. And so I ended up going for a while down a slightly different path. But in the end of the day, it's like when you get into this position where like you love the topic, you love the people, there's a lot of things that line up. You know, I feel incredibly privileged and honored to have spent the time I spent there and had a beyond an amazing experience at the company. I'm a huge fan of the company.
You know, in Harvard at the time, and this is before, you know, obviously before the social network, before everyone, their mother was doing a startup. Did you think that you were going to be, did you know you were going to be an entrepreneur? And I know you'd been exposed to it because your dad was a lawyer and was writing patents.
Yeah. I mean, so I actually, the before Facebook launched, I had started with a good friend of mine, Tali Rappaport, who's now runs product at Lyft. We had started something called Crimson Exchange. Ironically, with another guy, Nick Elprin, who is now running an awesome company called Domino Data Lab out here, and Slo is actually an investor in. But the three of us had started this thing, which was local Harvard-only eBay. And you had to have a Harvard FAS email address to use it. And it was for moving, you know, dorm goods around, basically. The idea being that college campuses turn over all their stuff all the time. And so Tali, I mean, even before Facebook, I had been like starting companies. I started a company in high school. Like, to me, the internet always represented this like amazing point in time where we were opening up these like three new human superpowers. We can remember everything. We can talk to everyone on Earth instantly for free and process like an unbelievable amount of data. It just seems like the most exciting and disruptive thing that could ever happen. So I kind of always knew I was going to want to start things. But man, there's been a ton of lessons along the way, right? About what it means to actually get it done, how unglamorous it is in a lot of ways. And the payoff, I think, is worth it. But man, it sucks.
was drop.io the first thing you started after college?
That was the first thing that was like a full-time job for me after college. I'd done a little bit of investing and helped some companies, but drop.io was like the thing that we were like, we're going to go do this and stop making money at Bain. And like I faxed in the incorporation documents, remember faxes? I faxed in the incorporation documents from the Bain New York office, like literally on my way out the door. And for us, it was actually just really a ton of excitement around Amazon Web Services. That was like why we started it. We were pretty early in terms of like getting deep on that. I got to go, I was in the very early days on the Amazon Web Services Customer Advisory Board, which was a great eye-opening experience for me as a kid. We were just like unbelievably excited that this was going to be a huge deal and change how people could move media around. And so we did a bunch of cool stuff around that in a lightweight way.
Take us through the Drop.io story and kind of the lessons learned from that. And you know, what would you do differently if you?
I mean, again, it was years of a startup. The really short version is got really excited about Amazon Web Services and like the potential around that. Saw a huge problem in moving media. You have to think backwards amazingly. What was it like to 2007 when we started this? It was a long time ago. You know, I think Dropbox existed, but barely. Box.net was a unit that went on your Facebook profile to share music. Right, it was not an enterprise company at all, and people were just like, it was actually pretty hard to move media around. And so Drop.io was a system where it was super lightweight, there was no sign up, it was completely like anonymous based on URLs, and you could stick a file in and we convert it into a bunch of other formats so you could read it on your Sidekick and BlackBerry and whatever else you needed to kind of interact with it on. And we did a bunch of experiments around collaboration and things like that. It went pretty well, honestly. Like in New York, we raised VC, we went from zero to a few million users on a monthly basis because a few million monthly users used to be cool. started like turning on a little bit of revenue from enterprise clients and things like that. It was going well. But in the end of the day, like life is incredibly short. When I think back, would I have enjoyed building for the next bunch of years another file sharing service, which would have been somewhere between and also ran and somewhat successful. I mean, there's a bunch of things that like look like that out there, or having gotten to participate in, I think what's, one of the, if not the, one of the iconic companies of our generation, and building something that I can honestly say, like all of my friends and most of the people I know use at least occasionally. Like, I think when that became the opportunity presented, it was pretty clear what the decision was.
And, Peter Kafka wrote an article at the time, the headline was like, Mark Zuckerberg really, really, really wants to work with Sam Lessin.
That's flattering. I don't remember that. I certainly really wanted to work with Mark Zuckerberg. I think like he, I have unbelievable respect for him, right? Like he is brilliant, but also just like a very good person. And I think that gets missed a lot, right? Is like he's really, I've known him a very long time, well before he was Mark Zuckerberg. And he's, his heart has always been in the right place. And I always think he's had like incredibly good product instincts. And the cool thing to watch him grow as a leader over a long period of time, where, his ability to learn quickly is shocking. It's probably like the thing his ability to adapt is awesome. And I think having spent a bunch of years working very closely with him, like I think I learned a lot from that, which was incredibly valuable and a lot of fun.
Walk us through what it's like when your company gets acquired and your financial position just totally changes. Like, tell us a story about that time. Or
It didn't change that much. I mean, remember, first, Facebook was not public, right? So it's not like, all of a sudden your bank account goes, it's not like, a movie where your bank account goes from zero to a gajillion dollars or anything, right?
For me, I had... when I was in New York, I had the fortune to make a bunch of like pretty good investments. So like I was the first investor in Birchbox and the first investor in Venmo and a very early investor in MakerBot and a lot of these companies. So again, like it wasn't like, one of these stories. I think Charles Forman, who's a great guy, has a great story about when his company was acquired and his bank account literally went from like negative $5,000. Like he literally like had negative money in his bank account to like whatever the number was, like $20 million or something. Like that was his story. That's not my story. And it's never been about that. For me, it's more just about like what happens on day one when you go and you have your product, which you're really proud of and is yours and you're building and has a few million users on a month, and you're kind of like building it up, to going into a Facebook office and looking at the chart, the graph of a statistic or a user metric, and the chart looks the same, right? The chart looks the same. The difference is that the basis in the numbers is has dramatically more zeros in it. And you're like, whoa. All of a sudden, you know, that's not base 1,000, that's base 1 million.
Yeah. You were angel investing kind of before it was incredibly cool to angel, before everyone was angel investing. And just out of college too.
In New York, again, I have to give a lot of credit. Like, I'm not, you know, I had a lot of early exposure thanks to my dad on this stuff, right? My dad was doing a lot of angel investing in the 90s. And he had kind of a really cool open door policy, which meant that I got to go to a lot of meetings, even as a high school student, and learn from a lot of entrepreneurs that I had like no business being in. And it's funny because every once in a while I'll run into someone in the Valley and they'll be like, oh, I met you when you were 12. And I'm like, that's awesome. And they're great people. So I think I had like a very unfair advantage for my dad in terms of getting exposure to this stuff. And I loved it. And I think I learned a lot. It is one of those things where like I had some brilliant blinding insight before everyone else. I think I just was exposed to it as a kid. And then for me, in terms of the stuff I invested in New York and still invest in with Slow and things like that, it just comes down to awesome people, right? Like, you meet really cool people with awesome ideas. Hopefully you've seen enough over time that you have some instincts about what's awesome and what's not, and like some pitfalls you can contribute to the conversation. But, you know, when you look at like MakerBot and Brie or like Birchbox and Haley, I mean, Haley's a great example. I literally, you know, I had known her since we were literally the first day of college, right? And we had been talking about stuff for years. And then she was like, I'm starting this company. And I was like, great, right? I don't know. I don't think I was ahead of the curve. I just think I had some great exposure and some great friends.
Exposure is one thing, but you've made great picks. I mean, to be first in Venmo, to be first in Birchbox, or maybe it is all great people. But what are some other things you look at when you think about angel investing, when you're advising others who are just starting to get into angel?
So I think the first thing really is people. Like there's basically three things that I care a lot about. One is who are the people, and second is like what are their motivations. And, you know, you can have very funny arguments about like dark side and light side motivations and companies and, you know, how they're thinking about the world. But even great people, you know, you have to understand why they're doing what they're doing and why they're driven to do it. Because, you know, this, like, these things get so difficult that if your motivations aren't right, you're just going to end up like very unhappy and attracting the wrong people around you and building the wrong stuff. And so I think that's like the second thing. And then the third is like, well, I guess the third, maybe I'll add a fourth. The third obvious one to me is just like, it has to be meaningful, right? Like, a lot of people build stuff and you're just like, I don't even care if this exists, right? Or if it exists, like, great, it like changes how X, Y, and Z small thing happens. But like, we're at a time of fundamental change. And so to me, like, you have to be going after enormous visions, or like, I'm personally not as interested, right? My rationale for that is like, look, these things are so unlikely to work in a lot of ways, and there are so many failure cases that like, if it works, it has to be enormous in order to offset all the pitfalls, right? Like, and that's both in terms of motivation and who you attract in terms of talent, but it's also just like, you know, a numbers game. Like, you know, if you want to, you know, the joke would be like something like an Uber can offset a hell of a lot of zeros, right? If you're angel investing. Now, there's a counter argument to that, which is evolving, which is we're at this interesting tipping point where all of a sudden there's a lot of like very large, relatively obvious businesses that can be disrupted by technology. So you can make a counter argument, which is like, don't worry about these huge swings. Instead, just like go after a bunch of like very clearly good companies with good people. But I've always kind of tended toward the other mode, which is like, what are the big things that are going to change how everyone lives? What are the big things that matter to the world? And if you have awesome people who are motivated for the right reasons working on those things, those are good bets to make.
Yeah. And you started, you know, you just started Finn, but do you have a request for startups? Is sort of that if someone's building this thing and if they're great, you'll find
it. I make requests for startups all the time on Twitter and Facebook. Like, I think I'm like a request for startup factory. There's a bunch. My most recent one, which might fit my own criteria of like world changing, but I really want is like, I hate all these, you know, photo editing suites for like photo books that like make me pick the photos. It's like, I take way too many photos at this point, as I think most people do for this. It's like, can someone please just make a service right? That like, I give all you all my photos and tell you what I want and you make it good. Like, I don't want to like edit this stuff anymore, right? So you can say, when you come and pitch me that, then I'll be like, oh, the market is not big enough. And but like, in practice, I want that.
Yeah, that's funny. When you were thinking of Finn, were there other ideas that you were close to starting?
Yeah. But again, like for me, there's a small number of ideas that I like are big ideas that like I get personally really excited about. And I went back to this mantra, which is like, who are the people going to be if I work on this, right? Like, what are the actual motivations and how big a deal is it? Finn is by far, if we can get it to work, the biggest possible deal that I can come up with, right? Like, we, you know, kind of have this, if you really want to be abstract about it, the thesis is search sucks, right? And like, we can build something dramatically better for people in a different model. And that's a pretty big aggressive thing. But, you know, I talk a lot, I'm obsessed with drones. There's a few things around them that like, I don't personally have the expertise to pull off, but like, I was tantalized by. And I also think like, you know, I gave a presentation a very long time ago. One thing I actually do claim somewhat being ahead of the curve on is this whole millennials don't want to own, everything's on demand rental world. I gave a TEDx talk a long time ago on this. And like, if there's one piece of intellectual credit I'd ever liked in my life, I'd like some for calling that a little bit early. But there's some things around that that I'm pretty into that, you know, a few friends and I like worked on, thought about some ideas around. Ultimately, those will happen. Like, all that other stuff will happen, and I'd love to be involved and fund it, and I have viewpoints on it. But for me, it's like, look, Cortina is like the best entrepreneur. I know his motivations, and I know my motivations, and I believe in them. And then if we can get this to work, it's very meaningful.
Motivations, you said, was one of your big three or big four components. What's an example of not good motivations or motivations you don't want to fund?
I think people start companies. I think there are some entrepreneurs who start companies vindictively, right? Which is like, or they start companies because all their friends are starting companies, or they start companies because they think it's going to make them rich. Like, I could like list a bunch of reasons that like I just don't gravitate towards in terms of like good reasons for starting a company. For me, it's like I look for people who are just like really ambitious, but also like deeply feel some problem and deeply have a story about why they care. Because if you don't personally have a reason you personally care about it, it's just not going to work.
So I'm curious, with all your exposure that you had, because your dad was in it early and all the things that you were seeing in high school, did you think about not attending college?
No. I did advise my sister a few years ago to not attend college, and she did not listen to me. But no, I was from a pretty academic family also. And the idea of not graduating from college was a little beyond my my personal leap at that point. No, I wasn't in that boat. And look, I love education. I loved college. I'm a huge fan of it. I don't think it's for everyone at all. And I do think that, like, again, like I told my little sister this, like, it's a lot of time and a lot. It's if you have other things you're passionate about, that's cool. I don't think it's a total given. Ironically, I mean, like, a lot of my close friends didn't go to college. Some of them didn't graduate from high school, which is truly impressive. But I was not on that bandwagon. I was very clearly going to make it through.
So why did you advise your sister not to go to college when college was so, you know, important to you? That's where you met a lot of people you're working with today.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just trying to like right the wrongs in my own life. I think I advise. I think for me it was more just, you know, you get to a certain point, and I think you have to ask yourself like, why are you doing the things you're doing versus doing the obvious things that are put in front of you, right? And I think for a lot of, you know, again, like very lucky people, like college is just put in front of them, and so they do it because it's in front of them. And I don't think they have that, again, like if you think about those three things, which is what's the big goal and like, who's the person and like, what's their motivation? They don't really have a motivation for college, right? Or they're not really thinking very much about it. And so, I don't know. I actually think college was awesome for my sister. She grew a lot. I'm seeing her in like 2 days and she's about to graduate. But so I think it probably is good that she went to college, but if she had had something else that she was super passionate about that like was her path and she had decided not to, then I think that's great. So I don't know.
Do you think college is going to radically change in the sense that, you know, when you have kids, do you think they're going to be going to something that's completely different?
Well, I think education is going to completely change. I actually think those institutions will still very much be there and be wonderful. One of my big things with college is, and I've talked about this a few times, is I do not understand why you ever leave college, right? Like, name another institution that kicks you out after 4 years, right? Especially one that's like, you can't name it. It's like, generally, if you have an institution you have deep allegiance to, you don't leave. Like, the church doesn't throw people out, right? And so I think, and I also think education as a thing, it's like clear that we are constantly needing to learn new things, right? Like, you know, one thing I did post Facebook immediately is I would never consider myself an engineer. I programmed, but I was like never really a real engineer. And I hadn't touched any coding in years when I left Facebook. And so what was the first thing I did is I went and I did a general assembly boot camp, right? And like learned all the new tools and like met some great new people, some of whom ended up working with my wife. And like, it was awesome. And so I think that constant education is clearly part of the future, whether that's, you know, digital and like learning things on Stack Overflow as you go, or in class and in person or whatever. So college is going to, education is definitely going to change.
I mean, if you're Harvard, you must feel a little silly that the biggest company of our time was invented in your halls, and then the kids dropped out to pursue it full time. How do you think Harvard?
I don't think so. I mean, that seems like a great outcome, right? Like, you created a context which brought together a bunch of amazing people that would have never met otherwise, mm-hmm. right? And they learned from each other and worked together and did something amazing. I don't think Harvard feels any regret. I mean, I wouldn't, if I were, you know, running Harvard, feel bad about that. I think that's amazing. It is what it is, right?
No, it's interesting. And when you post Facebook, when you were thinking about the next steps in your career, how did you think about operating versus venture and why?
So slow is easy. Like, Dave and Kevin are unbelievably good friends, and slow is something that, you know, originally, you know, David started and then Kevin started working really heavily on, and I had been an investor in for a while. And for me, it was like, I'd always done my own investing and then also kind of, you know, worked with slow a little bit or showed them things I was really excited about. And I knew after Facebook, I was going to keep investing in some form. And, you know, whether that would have been with a big venture capital firm or with, you know, kind of slow as a kind of a new venture capital firm or on my own, I knew that was going to happen. And for me, slow is like, I love working with friends. I love that intersection. I love the kind of mentality of like the firm and like what it's invested in and like how it approaches investing and the ideas that it gets excited about. And I wasn't ready. Again, if you look at slow, Dave, Kevin, and Will, who are the other partners on it, are all full-time at this point. And they're like, this is what they're doing. I like spend a lot of time on slow and I love investing, but like, I'm running a company with Cortina. Like, that is what I'm doing, you know, like that's the office I'm in right now, right? Like, that's what I do with my time. And then slow is something I get to be, you know, involved in every investment decision and like help drive in a lot of ways. That's a cool balance. Because I wasn't ready. I mean, being a VC has its negatives.
The Greylocks, the Benchmark, you know, the standard VC firms. And what are some of the negatives?
Well, I toured them. I wouldn't say I toured them. I would say that I have a lot of friends. I know the partners, many of the partners very well, and have a ton of respect for them and think they're wonderful people I love spending time with. There's a huge difference between operating and investing. Investing is about being, you know, a coach and being there every once in a while, but like, you can never possibly really know what's going on with a company or really like help drive it day to day. You absolutely can occasionally offer a great outside viewpoint or help something along or help come up with an idea. But I get too much joy from building things. And I get too much joy personally from kind of the day-to-day process of like refining a product and having people use it and being proud of having contributed something. And, you know, I kind of like to think about it this way, which is, one thing that almost every company, this is like the new millennial thing, is everyone talks about impact. What is the impact of the thing you're doing? I think you have to be really careful about understanding the impact of the things you're working on versus your impact. There's a difference. And the difference really comes down to, you know, would this have happened had you not been around, right? Would this have happened if someone else was running it, if someone else had made this decision? And for me, again, like, there's so much I respect out of investors. I bet someday I will be a full-time investor because I love it and it's fun. And like, there's a lot of things that I think I'm like reasonably good at it. But I don't think you get that personal impact dopamine hit investing the way you can operating. Now, the downside is much lower too. Like, you can't get crushed the same way. It's less of an emotional roller coaster. There's a lot of things, and it's again, you get this incredible eclectic broad exposure to things. Like, I can go on and on about the positives of being an investor and like how amazing a job it is, but I still need my operations. That was a real impact dopamine hit that you cannot get, I think, as an investor. And I don't think I think really to some degree that's just what happens at some big companies too, is it becomes harder to get those dopamine hits.
So you said about, if I didn't do this, someone else would do it. That's Kevin Kelly has this rule about this as well. He's like, if someone else is going to do it, just give it to them and then try to do something that you uniquely.
I mean, it's in some ways, if you think about it, unbelievably egotistical, right? But it is how I operate and what I believe. And it's kind of how I think I can add value, or I think I try to add value to the world or do something is about that unique contribution. If someone else is going to do something or someone else can do something, they should do it, and you should be psyched they're doing it, and you should get the benefit from the fact they did it, and that's all wonderful. It's just, when I get out of bed, the thing that really, like, more than anything drives me is just, like, what can I do today that wouldn't have happened without me?
I'm going to move on to some broader questions. What's something that you used to fervently believe that you now see as fundamentally misguided? Maybe it's around starting companies, maybe it's around investing, maybe it's something personally or intellectually.
That's a great question. I'll put it this way. I think I used to have a fair amount of disdain for what I would call operators. And what I mean by operators is, like, people who are not coming up with the ideas, they're not motivating the teams, they're not making the breakthrough. They're coming in and, like, what I always saw is, like, pushing the ball forward every single day. And that doesn't, again, like, to be really clear, I think I always really deeply believed. I mean, I worked at Bain a long time. Like, I was always a big believer in, like, following the numbers and driving the numbers and things like that. But, like, I think I used to have a lot of disdain for what I consider, like, incrementalists. And what I've seen, I think this is with massive credit to Facebook. I think Facebook's where I learned this more than anything anywhere else, is a lot of times once you have the breakthrough or things like that, you need this bulwark of operators who are going to turn the crank day in, day out, bit by bit, and operate at a really, really high level in order to, like, do amazing things, right? So, like, and I think that's, like, that's a little bit skirting the question, because I wouldn't say it's something I fervently, like, believe that I now don't believe. But I used to, I think, have a fair amount of disdain for, I think, people, you know, who generally are working on, like, the things that are smaller. And I think I've seen those things add up really, really quickly and gotten a lot more focused on, like, what those mean and how those are great.
What's the best advice you've ever been given?
Again, that's a really hard, broad question, but I've given a lot of great advice in my life by a lot of people. I think I'll tell you one thing that, like, it fits in the advice category that someone once said to me that I think I actually just said to a group of people starting at Finn like 30 minutes ago. And so I'll repeat, because I think it's just a great thing to keep in mind, is, like, when you're working on problems or big challenging things, at every step, you have to earn the right to do the next step. And I like that framing and vocabulary of earning the right, which is, it's really easy to have, like, big ideas or whatever. In some ways, I think, actually, think about it, like, the biggest of big ideas are usually pretty lazy because they're pretty obvious, right? Like, we like to talk at the highest level at Finn about, like, what are we building? We're building, like, Her or Hal or whatever. And it's like, and everyone's like, oh, that's amazing. Like, actually, that's, like, a really lazy thing to say, right? Because it's so broad and so big. And obviously, if it existed, people wanted it, would want it. The question is, like, how do you do it and what's the next step? And so I think the best advice I ever was given is I was, you know, talking, I can't exactly remember the context, but I was talking with someone about a problem, how we had to do this and then this and then this and then this. And they're like, Sam, we have to win at this to earn the right to get to try to do that, right? And skipping steps is where I think a lot of people who get excited about ideas get tripped up.
Mm-hmm. In your career, have you ever thought that you might have an interest in politics or government? Yeah.
So I think this goes back, maybe in 10 years, I'll come back on a Pride Hunt podcast and talk about, like, how I have newfound respect for the hard work of politics. I I love the world we live in where you can kind of make bets or build things and be right and win without a lot of coordination. I have some friends who are starting to go into politics and doing things. I have a huge amount of respect for their patience. I don't have the patience for it. And I don't know. I think it's tough because I think politics has obviously a massive impact on the world. And there's like a bunch of great stuff and great opportunities in that area. It's also bluntly, from my perspective, and I think many people's perspective, totally messed up. And usually when things are totally messed up, there's opportunities to make them better. But I don't know. Right now in my life, I don't have the fortitude or patience to deal with the political process.
Chris Hughes just wrote a Medium post saying that the New Republic is for sale and that he's looking for something else. Interesting story of someone who's successful in tech trying to do something in a different world. And it'll be interesting to see how and, you know, facing a lot of trouble doing so.
Chris is great. And like, look, there are good fights to be fought. But I do think we live at this time where, I mean, for better and worse, it's in some ways a lot easier to build new things than fix broken things. Right. And so there's a question about how you want to spend your time. Right. And like, what do you want to invest in? Like, I have a lot of respect for people who turn around big companies, you know, and there's some great examples of people doing it. But man, that's hard. Right. Like that seems like infinitely harder and the payoff isn't there. And especially for me, because like I'm kind of like a dopamine junkie on this stuff. It's like, it's not for me.
of thinkers that, you know, many of my close friends and deeply respect and you deeply agree with. But I want you to say if there's a difference of opinion intellectually on a certain topic that strongly comes to mind.
This first, seems like a really hard game, by the way, but go for it.
If it is, if it's too hard, just skip. Mark Andreessen.
I mean, how can you not have respect for him? Like, I'm sure there's a bunch of stuff I disagree with him about.
Yeah.
Like, I can't think of any single thing where I'm like, Mark Andreessen's wrong. I can't. This is going to be a really hard game.
Okay.
I've gotten to spend some time with him. I think he's really smart and has super interesting viewpoints on a lot of things. And I'm sure if you made me read a bunch of his tweets, I'd come up with stuff I disagree with. But I don't know how those. I'm not that facile.
How about Dave and Kevin? Is there something on the investment thesis or certain fields that you guys have?
We argue all the time, right? We argue all the time. I mean, that's part of the fun is with friends, you can argue in a productive way and you understand how to argue with each other. One that comes to mind is like, as a consumer, I love hardware, right? Like I have a bunch of drones. Like there's lots of hardware I like as a consumer. As an investor, I think I have the hardest time making hardware investments versus Dave and Kevin, who I think see a lot more depth there, are like much more bullish on it. And that doesn't mean like the reality is like the debate is where the answers come out on these things. Like that's actually one of the benefits of investing with friends versus on your own is you get to have more passionate debates. But yeah, like I have a really hard time with hardware. And I think the other guys are like more okay with it. More for me, just because like it's so complicated, right? Like compared to like the stuff, services, marketplaces, like a lot of the stuff that I like I think hardware has like this incredible set of ways it fails. And then even when it works, because it's physical and has to be distributed, it's really hard to make huge businesses. Now that said, like, you know, Slow is an investor in Lilly, which is crushing it, right? And like, was an investment that, you know, I think Dave led originally. And again, like, I couldn't be happier with that. But I don't know. That's one of many debates.
What has Slow become?
Well, I think we're still figuring that out. But here, I mean, the history of Slow is really simple, which is we were all angel investors. We all actually pooled money together in a few funds that were the original Slow funds, which Dave originally was managing, and then Dave and Kevin. And that was all just personal capital that we pulled together because we liked debating and arguing with each other and being aligned with each other. And then this most recent Slow Fund, which is, you know, the fund that I joined and helped raise and then execute, is the first fund where we have outside capital. And it's not just our money effectively, and it's at a much bigger scale, and it's the beginning of, you know, hopefully a lot more. And I think for us, it was more just like we were seeing such awesome stuff. Right. And because we were seeing awesome stuff with awesome people, you know, all those kind of themes that I talked about, like there was so much great stuff and there was so much clear demand for, you know, more capital in great things. It's like, why would you not kind of start scaling up? And so I don't know, I don't have like a super articulate opinion right now on like how VC is changing holistically. I do think it is changing for sure. But I don't have like some narrative that like I could put a stake in the ground and be like, this is how VC is going to work in 10 years, and this is Flow's position. For now, I just think it's like a firm where, you know, we all really like each other. We get to see amazing things and see awesome entrepreneurs. And then it's great to have more capital to support them.
So if you were going to give a TED Talk today, and the premise was like, predict the trend that's upcoming, what would it be?
I think that probably the two things that I think are true are, I think we're still at a very early part of the curve, not the end of the curve, on a lot of the things we're starting to see. So you look at everything from self-driving cars. Everyone loves talking about the impact of self-driving cars and like, oh, it's going to be amazing. The roads will be faster and whatever. But like, it goes so much further than that, right? Like, I think that like self-driving cars, when they happen, are going to mean like real estate prices change dramatically. Like the balance between urban and suburban shifts dramatically. Bluntly, like people live in much smaller homes. Like there's all these like crazy implications to some of these technology changes that I think people are underestimating, not overestimating. Same thing goes with social networking, which, you know, is not in vogue as a term right now. We've moved on to like messengers, but really just like what it means to have communication. Like my biggest, craziest idea is I am pretty sure that our generation of communications technology is going to end capitalism. Because if you think about it,
you heard
like,
it here.
Capitalism. No, I like, and I've actually given like versions of this talk. I would get this. You know what? If you force me to give one crazy TED talk, it would be this. I've written about this in the information. I've talked about it a little bit, but like, here's the framework. All the cash economy is a communications platform, right? There's 7 billion voices. We don't know who to serve in what way or who to interact with how. If you walk into a town and you don't know anyone, you need to trade with them. You have no ability. They don't know who you are. You don't know who they are. You don't know who to trust. You don't know who to trade with. So we have this really, really elegant, low bandwidth solution called dollars. And we just like basically have all agreed to trust the central authority and like deal with these dollars. And it's a proxy for communication. Now that we actually can know each other, can talk to each other, can trade with each other. I mean, I have this whole narrative on how like basically the last 100 years has been about the switch from social currencies to financial currencies, like women entering the workforce. That was not about the economy growing. That was just about basically starting to count a bunch of the economy, which was local and community-based, and like monetizing it, right? And I think our generation is going to swing that back, right? And that the cash economy might not shrink, but it's going to stop growing in the same terms. It's going to be very decoupled from the actual economy of goods and services traded. And the backbone for all of that is going to be messenger services, is going to be social networks, is going to be identity. So I don't know. The craziest thing that's going to happen, even beyond, and there are going to be many crazy things, is I think like the fundamental underpinnings of how we interact and trade with each other are three little superpowers of memory, right, and communication and processing are just going to totally overhaul how we interact with each other.
On VR, and what's the timetable?
So I have been so pissy about VR for a long time. Because my view has just been like, yes, this goes in the category of how, like, yes, of course this is going to happen at some point, like, duh. But like, I don't like games. And this seems like a bunch of hype going on and like goes way further out than people are giving it credit for. And even if you build the hardware, which is really hard and like not clearly even that close, then like the content is going to be impossible to I could name 50 reasons I hate VR. That said, for the first time, I've done the demos of most of the VR systems multiple times. For the first time, the most recent time when I saw the most up-to-date demo of Oculus, I like had fun. I went from being like, this is boring and everyone thinks, like, I don't care about some stupid shark swimming around. This is terrible, right? And like, I don't like, but having hands in the system and the speed and speeding up, like it was the first time I didn't want to instantly take it off and just go and write about how stupid this was. So like my basic view is I still think it's really far out and like gonna take a long time to live up to promise and things like that. But the fact that I had fun and like wanted to keep playing made me dramatically less fundamentally skeptical than I was a few months ago.
This one's from Mazio. What is the strangest and or funniest use of Finn so far?
Mazio, wasn't it your use case where you're like building an arcade or something and looking up all the parts? the funniest use case. I mean, like, honestly, Finn is just really focused on three things. It, like, helps you message people and remember to interact with people and find stuff. And so it's, you know, there's a lot of people who, like, use it. The most interesting thing for me has been people who just, like, chat with it. They, like, just want someone to chat with. I thought that people had enough other people to chat with in the world, but, like, people are lonely or, like, have these moments and they just want to have fun conversations. And so that's been a little bit surprising, but I don't know. When I think about, like, what it is and what it does, it really is kind of those three key things. And while some of the searches are kind of funny, the reality is like, they're just people trying to find answers to things that otherwise take a bunch of queries and are complicated and annoying to do. So I don't know. Mazio, I hate that. You might hate that answer, but I think you might win for trying to build an arcade with it.
Yeah, I spent time at Mazio's house. I've seen the arcade. It is incredible.
I'm sure it was all due to Finn, and Mazio did no work.
That's funny. Okay, so Sam, this has been a fantastic chat. Thank you for taking the time. You know, what are some last plugs? The product and audience, a lot of entrepreneurs, early adopters. You know, where can they see Finn in action? Where can they find you online? Cool.
Yeah, fine. I mean, I'm in lots of places online. You can find me online. Just message me on one of many platforms. Look for Lesson. Yeah, I mean, on the Finn stuff, it's like we're having a blast. It's early. If you're really into these kind of core use cases, like, you can reach out to me. Although we're, like, really not adding that many people that quickly onto the system right now. But look for more from us coming up around kind of this core, just RFM. Remember, find message. And on the slow stuff is, like, look, just, I don't know, like, I love talking to entrepreneurs that are doing cool things. And, you know, slow is an awesome vehicle for me to get to do that with some awesome friends. And if, you know, there's cool stuff you're working on that is, you know, globally impactful and you're doing it for the right reasons, like, you know, we'd love to hear about it.
That's perfect, Sam.
All right. It's good to see you. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Thank you, Sam. Have a great day.